This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Good to be with you today. Matt, Patrick, Brett will stop on by, as well as Patrick Cooligan. Dr. Joe as well, coming up here at 435. How are you, Patrick?
Doing all right. I was at the ball game on Sunday, and that was a game the Twins were badly outplayed and yet still managed to win the game.
Yeah, well, that's the team. That's going to be the new logo, is both Minnie and St. Paul just going, somehow they're doing it. I don't know. So let me tell you a little story. Now, first of all, thank you very much to Todd Mickelson, who was kind enough to fill in for me for 2 days, because I left this show on Friday, or Thursday, rather. It was a fantastic show with Ilhan Omar and Anita Gall and Robert Burrill. Doing great, flying high, because I was headed up to the cabin for the weekend. And we had already in the process of packing. We were getting ready to go up there, you know, looking forward to a long weekend up north. I get a call from my brother, who's up there right now. He's up at the cabin. And he tells us one of the guests has come down with COVID. And you're like, okay. And I kind of knew at that point that I wasn't going up north, but I still sleep. I'll tell you what, let's chat in the morning, see how things are going. Okay, great. Because I knew at that point that was not going to happen. And so, yeah, what ended up happening was, you know, Todd Mickelson's an absolute dreamboat of a fill-in host. I love having the guy fill in. He does the work. He has the fill-in hours. I don't want to yank that away from him, so I let him just fill in the shows. And I had what I'm calling the lost weekend in Minnesota, and I'll get back to that here in just a little bit. I'll get back to that. But I want to take a few moments, because it really is something, and this is one of the reasons I got Dr. Joe on today, is I want to talk to him about this, because first of all, this is something where there are actually starting to see more and more COVID cases pop back up again. I know multiple people. I mean, it'd been months where I didn't know anyone that with COVID, or it was someone distance, a friend's aunt or someone there. All of a sudden, I'd say in the last 4 weeks, I have fairly direct connections to people who have had COVID or are coming down with COVID. So this whole idea that COVID is not a problem anymore, I think we're starting to eat that. It's starting to come back to us. But it took me, and I took some time to talk about this, because I don't know about you guys, but COVID sucked. You know, it sucked for everyone. Some people's way of dealing with it was to say, I don't care. I want my chicken wings. Your grandma can die. I don't care. Those people are jerks. You know, that's if you had someone who was screaming, I don't care. The public good is no good to me. I want to watch a college football game on TV in a sports bar. If that was someone you knew, you probably don't know them that much anymore, because... Like I said, and how many times did I repeat this over the last few years? We lost the sense of what the common good is. You know, as Republicans sit here and scream about, whatever happened to Mayberry? You know, I don't remember Barney saying, the heck with you, Andy. I'm going to go down to that restaurant and I'll cough all over everybody. It was a heck of an episode. Oh, that was a heck of an episode. Yeah. Anyway. He had a flag with him. No, I don't want to get into that. I did think a lot about COVID and those people. Isn't it hilarious how when COVID was really bad for 2020 and 2021, when it was really bad, that when anyone died, it wasn't COVID. It was whatever else they had. They died of a hangnail. They didn't die of COVID. Remember that? You know how nothing was COVID? Everything was whatever else they had that there couldn't have possibly been. But now those same exact people, now that anyone dies, it wasn't cancer or a heart condition or anything. It was, they got the vaccine. And the vaccine's murdering everybody. Well, they had cancer. No, they didn't. They were perfectly healthy until you got the vaccine. No, I'm their son. I should know they had cancer. No, you didn't. You're a crisis actor. You're not even real. Once again, if you're playing at home, for 2 years, it was, no one was dying of COVID. And now it's, no one dies of anything else but the COVID vaccine. Yeah, rational thought processes. They're loon balls. But going back to the fact that this was a bit of a reminder of the fragile world that we lived in. And one of the reasons why, I mean, it was a reminder of why COVID was really bad. And you wanted to be able to kind of tiptoe around it and sort of treat it like something else, and it wasn't. And that's what we couldn't do with COVID. It led to millions of people dying of COVID because people were not taking it seriously until it was too late. Still people today, face diaper, because they feel as if that somehow is making their argument more appealing. The truth is, and obviously now, first of all, I want to make sure I say this. The person that has COVID, it sounds like they're feeling better. That's the good news. No one else up there has COVID. That's also the good news. But yeah, the suspicion is they might have picked it up at the airport. We're not knowing. This individual wore a mask the entire time, so it is unclear when or how they were exposed, but that would have been their guess. My brother had the same kind of thing happen to him a few months ago. He was actually overseas. I think it was in Prague. It was in Prague, and they flew into Prague, and they were both not feeling very well once they got off the airplane, and both of them got COVID and were in Prague stuck in a hotel room with COVID, which, yeah, I can only imagine what the cable system like, what it must have been like there. Maybe I'll pick up the language in a few days. There's lots of weird shapes on top of all these vowels. Anyway, good luck with that. The most important thing is the health of the individual. I've said this from the beginning of the COVID pandemic. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. And I don't want you bankrupt. I don't. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. And I don't want you bankrupt. I don't. That's just me. That has always been the priority. But having kind of been away from COVID for a little bit, there was this part of me, and this was kind of that, I'll call you back tomorrow and see how things are going, which was a call back to what we used to do. It's not the first time we've had people go to the cabin, and like anyone that are sick, when we have sick kids, you get some food poisoning, whatever the case may be. In the past, what had happened was what? Either the person kind of stayed in their room and were there and everyone else came up and had fun because there was not a lot of, you know, chance of everyone else getting sick. It just wasn't, didn't work that way. And so that was the option. Or, you know, and sometimes, I don't know about you, but there had been some times where there was one person that was really, really sick. And what we made the decision of to do is to give them a better bathroom facilities and some privacy. We actually went and rented a hotel room and put them into the hotel room. And they, you know, it was for like 4 days of them being sick, but they eventually got out of it. I mean, the worst thing that we used to get on any kind of consistent basis was the flu. And if you ever had the flu, holy God, I had the flu once years ago. I will never not get a flu shot. the flu shot. Oh, I was sick for 2 weeks. For about 3 days, I could not even walk. I was that sick. I was crawling to the bathroom and crawling back to bed, and that's all I did. Just was horrible experience. But you still, back then, what did you do? You just kind of, you know, cleaned up and you know, put the person in a room and, you know, they'll be fine. Heck, nowadays you can even have DoorDash and all that stuff drop off food for you. Just say, hey, don't be at the door when I open the door because I'm sick. So, and it's happened. There you go. The fact is, I think one of the things which is an untold element of why we for 2 to 3 years had just a miserable time was that we did put back this inconvenience, this massive inconvenience, which once again is not the problem. Sure, there were the jerks out there. Sure, there were the people that were, God, you know, just stop talking. Just, you know, I get it. You don't think this is a problem, even though your own grandmother died. That, you know, I'm not buying it. Well, that's fine. I'm sure grandma's really happy with you. But the reality is most of us understood there was nothing here to like. There, what's to like here? And that was always the anti-vaxxers, the Republican, the Trump, you know, response was, you guys want to be happy if we get that vaccine. Well, yeah, because less people would get sick. Oh, I'm not going to make you happy. I'm not going to get it. The reality is that this is why this was such a drag and this was such an anchor on many of us, is because it wasn't just the fact that you're concerned about a sick loved one or a loved one's dying, but it was all this other level of inconvenience, which used to be the problem. I mean, that's what we used to gripe and moan about. We used to complain about, oh, we got to, grandma's not feeling well, so I guess we're going to get a hotel room or something like that. And kind of like that was a big deal. And all of that residual disdain that we had that was there, that's what permeated a lot of us and kind of really changed a lot of us. It wasn't just the illness. It was the fact that this was just demanded a level of caution and carefulness, which inconvenienced a heck of a lot of people. But to all of your credits, well, most of your credits, some of you were complete jerks, but to most of your credit out there, you did what was best for all of us, and you tried, and you managed, and you did what you did. Yeah, it was hard for people who had their entire Thanksgiving experience before that was to basically just bring a marshmallow Jell-O salad to grandma's house, and that was it. And suddenly you're at home, and you've got your own family, and they're expecting a Thanksgiving dinner, so you had to make one, or you had to figure out what you're going to do. Those were the inconveniences we used to get upset about. And I'm not dismissing those. I'm not saying that wasn't easy, but that's what was this thing. I mean, this is why there was just this burden, and it still is there, folks. The fact that, you know, here you're hearing me talk about a person I know having COVID, and it dramatically impacted a lot of different things. This is what we kind of have to deal with. And I think the best thing you can do is the next morning, on Friday morning of last week, I get up and of course we're not going up north. Of course we're not, because it took me a few hours, and maybe because I was just so blindsided by this, I wasn't expecting it. But it was like I got back into COVID mode, and of course we're not going back up north. It did create what I like to call the lost weekend, which I'll talk about, you know, in length here for the rest of this hour. But at the same time, it was just having to be malleable, having to be amicable, having to have flexibility. These were things that we had to once again relearn again. Because the most important thing is that people don't get sick and people don't die. And right now, there are people who are listening to me say this, who are saying, so what? People get sick and die all the time. and you're a jerk, and you are a jerk, and I don't need to tell you that. You know you're a jerk, and you're proud of being a jerk. Just, I don't like you. And most people don't like you. That's kind of why it's a you know snowball that rolls downhill. This is why you're getting angry and angry at society, is because more and more people are like, you're kind of horrible. You know, you're just, that's what it is. But for the rest of us, I want you to be on alert, because this stuff will happen. And it's not like things we used to deal with prior to COVID. It's not like, you know, stomach flu, or they've got a little cold, or there's pink eye, or a kid's got a cough. It's not like those little things. It's much more serious. And if we get to the point where we're just like, oh, well, we'll go up there, COVID, they just stay in their room, they'll be fine. Well, we're going to start really seeing that snowball roll downhill really freaking fast. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the Progressive Voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. So here it is. It's Thursday, Friday morning. I've got a 4-day weekend. I'm not, my plans, which were in place, were not there. You know, one of the things I talk about is how amazing this city is, how amazing the state is. And so I went out and did a lot of different things. On Sunday, I did go see, I finally went and saw Dial of Destiny, the Indiana Jones movie. I enjoyed it. I thought the last 30 minutes or so were really entertaining. I thought that was a lot of fun. I really enjoyed that. Yesterday, I was out at the Minnesota Zoo. I did that treetop tour, which was a lot of fun. I did that. That was a good time. And we enjoyed doing that. I got my son's home because of, it's late summer. He's home for a little bit. So we went for a walk a little bit later and did that. But I want to kind of focus on two things. I want to focus on the Friday, what we did on Friday, and then what we did on Saturday. Because Saturday I'm going to talk about that a lot, because you'll get it when I get there. But on Friday, what I ended up doing was heading over to the Minnesota History Museum, and they had the Peanuts character, the Charles Schulz tribute that's over there, where they talk about the Peanuts characters and stuff like that. Very cool. I grew up with a Snoopy dog. That was my bedtime buddy when I was a kid. Love Snoopy. It's iconic. I have the complete collection of all the books at home. Love them. My kids love them. My son had a Snoopy dog when he was growing up. Both my girls have Snoopy dogs, although they have other, bedtime buddies that were their favorites. I grew up with them. I loved them. The holiday specials are still must watch during the holidays, particularly the Christmas, the Halloween, and the Easter ones. We watch those every year. And we love them. And as a matter of fact, even though my youngest child is now 16, we're watching that. That's not an option. We're watching it's particularly the Halloween and the Christmas one. Those are the ones that you're catching. It's a well laid out thing, but one of the things, and I guess I just didn't realize this, is that our love of Charles Schulz and Peanuts is a lot like our love of Bob Dylan. Sure, local angle, love that. But Dylan kind of left and went to New York City, and the rest is history. And sure, he sang about Minnesota, he talked about Minnesota, but there eventually comes a point where he is far longer not from Minnesota than he was from Minnesota. And I'm not saying that, I love Dylan. I love Dylan. I love his lyrics. I love his words. But, he was, you know, Prince never left. Prince was always here. This was Prince's town. You know, he always, what was that great line he said? I like New York. I like LA. I love Chicago. I love London, but I like Minneapolis better. And, you know, it's, you know, he stayed. I mean, it was kind of one of those things where, you know, it's, we have a tendency of loving people, especially when they leave. And the same thing goes with Charles Schulz. I never realized, I thought he didn't move out of the state until the 70s. He'd actually moved out of the state well before that, in the 1950s. In 1958, actually, if I'm not mistaken, he moved out to California. Sebastopol, California. I never heard of it. It's north of San Francisco, across the Golden Gate Bridge. He was up that way.
Yes, they have a Charles Schulz Museum in that city where he lived most of his life.
And understandably, they claim him as theirs. Understandably. Yet we here as well claim him as ours. Now, I want to say this. There is one... So you kind of wonder about this. I mean, one of the reasons why he moved out there when he did is that it was sparsely populated. They were able to buy a huge lot of land. He was able to build his own on-site studio to do all of his drawing in. And there was a lot of pluses for it. It doesn't seem like he had a lot of connection to California before he moved out there, but he did say, you know, he was not a fan of the weather, and he left. And I know that generally right there, that's enough to them's fighting words for some Minnesotans. But he was just not, you know, had young kids. They weren't the biggest fan of the weather, and so he left. At no point, I mean, his comic strip clearly depicted kids in Minnesota, you know, outside of when they was talking to Spike out in the desert. But no, his comic strip was very much a Minnesota-based strip. The winters and the snow and the skating and the summers. And yeah, I mean, he captured that quite a bit, quite well, if you ask me. But he was gone at 58. And that's kind of one of those things. It's like, you know, and I look around the room and there is so much that we here in Minnesota have done and fawned over and loved him. And I'm not saying you shouldn't love him. I love him. I one of my favorite stories I tell people is the last day of Camp Snoopy at the Mall of America. We took my son there. We saw the last show they did, where they had all the characters come on out and do the dance and singing and stuff like that. We saw the last show, and considering there was only like six people in the audience, my son was the last child to give Snoopy a hug at Camp Snoopy before Snoopy walked off stage, and that was the last show. That was it. My son gave him the last hug, and that was the end of Camp Snoopy. Now, that was not, you know, that was, you know, there's Cedar Point and that whole thing. I've gone over that before in past shows. We did the sculptures out in the street and stuff like that. And you know, at no point did Charles Schulz ever, I think it became clear that there was a lot of people that loved him and appreciated him from here because they felt as if he was representing Minnesota. He didn't shy away from Minnesota. I believe he helped greatly in helping to build the U.S. Hockey Hall of Fame of Eneveleth. He helped out with that. I mean, he was a guy that appreciated this. But I also think that going through that exhibit, one of the things I think it was kind of one of those things like, oh, this is interesting. People in Minnesota still like me. There is one thing that was in that article or in that exhibit, and I encourage you to go see it. It's worth it. Apparently, for his high school yearbook, he had drawn a whole bunch of images that were supposed to be included in the yearbook. And for some reason, the yearbook never included them in them. And this clearly upset him. I mean, it does not sound like he had a great time here in Minnesota, which is something we have to come to. I mean, I don't think you pack up and you move to California from Minnesota with no real experience in California if you're having a great time here. And I think his early days were so hard on him and so rough on him that it left him with a lot of grudges towards maybe not Minnesota as a whole, but a lot of the experience that he had here. He says he kept a stack of letters that he got from schools who wanted him to draw something they could include in the yearbook. And he kept that stack as a way to remind him that the people that when he was a high school kid turned him down or didn't put the pictures in the yearbook, that they were wrong. And he, look at all these people. I kept every one of them because why? Why did you keep them all? Because he clearly had a pretty big grudge. And he enjoyed saying, you know, every once in a while revisiting, and that school didn't like it. And now I'm here in California. I'm not saying you don't praise the guy. I'm not saying you don't love him. I love him. Trust me, I love Snoopy. I came this close to buying all three of my kids another Snoopy dog. Darn tootin'. Maybe a fourth one, one for me. I grew up with them. I love them. I really do. But it is interesting how we in Minnesota will have people that were here, who stay here, who love it here, who praise this state and love it. And it's not that we don't praise them, but we put that on the same level as a lot of other people who left at a fairly young age and never came back in the sense they never came back to live here. It's not that they didn't acknowledge they were from here. It just is they took off and they never looked back. And that's maybe the most Minnesota thing ever. The forlorn lover looking out the window, waiting for their hero to come back as they talk every day about, aren't they the greatest? Aren't they the greatest? Go see it. It's worth the time. But, you know, it was eye-opening for me that clearly when he left Minnesota, it wasn't like a hard decision for him. It really wasn't. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. I got to talk about what happened on Saturday because that was even more amazing for a lot of different levels. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Kiss me. I liked it better when you improvised a story we had. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So, I'll tell you what, let's get Penny in. Penny is in Minneapolis. You wanted to chime in on Charles Schulz. Welcome on in, Penny.
Hi, Matt. I totally agree with you about Charles Schulz. I think rather than a grudge, I was a lifelong follower like you were. I think it's more of a hurt. I think his work yes. shows he was a very emotional, sensitive person, all his characters. And I don't think it's a grudge. I think at that year, when you're that age, it was an emotional pain to him. And I also wonder what high school he went to. Just curious.
I'm not sure the high school, but will I say, Penny, if I can add, though, you're right. I think it was emotion early on which caused him to leave. But when you keep these letters from all these other yearbooks, and thanks, Penny, I appreciate the phone call. When you keep all these letters from all these other yearbooks who asked you for drawings, just to keep a list of how many people asked you for drawings after your school didn't put it in there, that's when it kind of merges and becomes a grudge. I don't think he necessarily was. I think he was, frankly, I think there is a few pictures there. You can see he's kind of flattered by all this, the love from Minnesota. And I think part of that is the fact that, you know, it wasn't like he was out there giving a Walt Whitman-esque speech on as the truck left out of the city. You know, it wasn't. It was, you know, I think he was just kind of surprised how much it resonated, but you know, he did leave. And I mean, he left early in the career. And so by the time you get to what is it? 58, he moved away. They didn't have the Christmas special was 62. So pretty much the height of the popularity, he wasn't a Minnesota cartoonist. He was a California cartoonist. And I think I think Penny was once again, right. I think a lot of that, him leaving was to do with, you know, he just didn't like how he had been treated at some points in the city. But I think some of that, when you store all the letters of all the people that asked you for your book drawings later on in life, just so you can look at them and kind of say, see, my school didn't want to put my drawings in there. I think it kind of becomes a grudge. So 952-946-6205. Still love him. Now, that was on Friday. Saturday, I wanted to get out of town a little bit. I mean, I love the city. Like I said, did the Minnesota Zoo, did the Minnesota History Museum, wanted to get set us chicken parm sandwich. Very solid choice there. I had fun in the city, but I like sometimes to get out and drive around because it doesn't take you, A, that long to drive to get out of the city, and B, there's some really cool towns around in outstate Minnesota. Whereas I'm not like a Republican, I refuse to go in the city. Those people are going to be mean to me. No. Minneapolis is brilliant. I love being in Minneapolis. But I also will go out to conservative rural areas because there's a lot of gems out there. And I was looking, and I went out, because I like history, I went out and I said, well, you know what? I've never been to the Mayo House in Le Sueur. And wait a second. Right down the street from there in St. Peter is the Traverse des Sioux treaty site. And I've driven past that a bunch of times, but I've never been. I'll get to that in a second. First of all, the Mayo House. Drive down there. Le Sueur, I want to put a challenge out to everyone out there. Okay, the craziest thing about the Mayo House in Le Sueur is not the fact that, you know, the Mayo family lived there. And it's a quirky little house. It's a quirky little place there right in downtown Le Sueur. And the family lived there early on. This was the dad. The two sons were the ones that really brought the Mayo Clinic to prominence. One of the sons was born there. The other son was born in Rochester, but this was the Mayo House as it stood in Le Sueur for the 6 years. I think it was 6 years they lived in that town. Might have been less. Might have been four. But anyway, it was worthwhile going through. The craziest part about the history of that house is about 40 years later, the Cosgrove family moves into the house. The Cosgrove family were part of the group that started the Green Giant Corporation. And as I'm going through this house, I said, has there ever been another house where, the Green Giant Corporation, I believe, was started when they lived in the house, but they started living there before Green Giant. Was there ever a house which ever housed two other families who were such icons of business later on in life? Because the Mayo family left and went to Rochester, and that was kind of the beginning of their journey down in Rochester. But the fact that this house saw the Mayo family and the family that helped found Green Giant, and I don't get the impression that the Cosgrove family bought it because it was the Mayo house. They just bought a house. That is nuts. That is nuts. I was stunned by that. It's worth going down there. I had a fantastic little tour guide that she took the time. I mean, I don't think there's a lot of people that come through for the historic tours. But she took the time to really go through everything, and it was really quite nice. And the house is quite interesting. Got to watch your head in a few spots, that's for sure. So, and that's just down in Le Sueur. That's, 45 minutes out of the city if you're on the southwest side of town. So off you go. The Traverse des Sioux Historic Site. That is a very different type of historic site. The Nicollet, I think it's the Nicollet County Historical Society, actually runs the museum on the site. That the Minnesota Historical Society's portion of it is just the trail that you take out into what was this town that was basically just north of St. Peter that existed before St. Peter. And it was one of the earliest towns in the state. I mean, it really was. And it was actually a gridded street and all these things. The museum that you go through, and I'm going to say this is actually a a complimentary statement, as much as it's probably not going to sound like it is. That museum is the biggest freaking Jekyll and Hyde museum I've ever been in my life. And it starts off with the ugly. It talks about how the white Europeans robbed the Native Americans. And it's interesting because a few months back, I went to Fort Ridgely, which is where the Dakota War of 1862 started, really. I mean, well, it started down at the Lower Sioux Agency, and then there was another attack, and then the major attack at Fort Ridgely. And that was the beginning of that conflict. These things did not happen independently, though. What this museum does, and when I talk about we have a long way to go to get reconciliation for what the hell happened, you've got to understand what the white Europeans did to the Native Americans. And this sham of a treaty that they put through was, okay, so at the time of the treaty was 1851. I say that because there is the actual site of the treaty is got a stone on it. And marking the site of the Treaty of Travis de Sioux, July 23rd, 1851. White Europeans had basically been emboldened by Andrew Jackson, that tyrant, who, when the Supreme Court ruled against him in regards to Native American land rights, he basically said, "You've got your ruling, now enforce it." And he ordered the military to forcibly remove the Native Americans from their land, the Trail of Tears that went across the country. And what basically it set the standard for was that the U.S. government, sure, some people felt bad. And let's be honest, they all knew what was going on. They all knew it. Some of them felt bad, but sure as hell, none of them were going to stop it. Not a single one was going to stop it. And they basically felt, you know, well, the president and the Congress, they're just going to ignore the Supreme Court anyway, so we'll just do what we want to do. Now, setting up this treaty, you have basically what this treaty did is give pretty much most of southern Minnesota. It went much further north on the western border up to Moorhead, but basically was up to about Hastings, Minneapolis, St. Paul on the eastern side. For the most part, the entire southern part of the state, that the United States took control of that territory. In turn, the Native Americans were supposed to receive a massive payout from the federal government for the land. They were supposed to, as well, get equipment, livestock, goods, help, basically building up what was supposed to be Native American territory, which ran the Minnesota River to the Dakota border. And it was supposed to be their territory. That was the case. Now, once again, we're talking treaties here. Treaties supersede the Constitution. So this was what they were supposed to get. They gave up their rights to most of southern Minnesota. They in turn got this stretch of land that was going to be their land. And they was going to be their land forever. There was an amazing amount of dishonesty in the people that were dealing with the Native Americans. As one point in this museum talks about, there's clearly people that were taking advantage of them, where they were getting paid $2,000 a year, which is a pretty good salary back then, but had hundreds of thousands of dollars in the bank. So they clearly were ripping people off. They figured out that they could earn the trust of the Native Americans if they offered up a trade that was accepted. And many of them did, and in turn ended up marrying Native Americans and becoming pseudo part of the tribe, per se. It was these people that basically pushed the Native Americans to sign this treaty. Not because it was good for the Native Americans, but it was going to make a heck of a lot of money for a lot of other people. At the same time, the white Europeans were fraudulently basically running up massive debt to the Native Americans. Many of them not even knowing how much, you know, that they were even in debt. But because they basically, the way they basically set things up, they created massive debt. It was just lie after lie after lie. The white settlers who became part of the tribe and were trusted by the tribe finally talked the tribes into giving up their land rights for southern Minnesota. In turn, they would get this that reservation territory that was going to be on the Minnesota River. That was going to be their land, tons of money and stuff like this. They sent the people on out. This is the treaty they signed at this site. They signed this treaty. The Native Americans signed on this treaty. Here's where this gets even crazier on how bad of a deceit this was. First of all, I'm just looking at the clock here. I got to get a break in. Let me get this break in really quick, and then I'll finish out the story and tell you why you have to go down there and why we still desperately need to make amends for how the Native Americans were treated, because they were just ripped off left and right. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. It's the Matt McNeil Show on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. So basically, we're at the treaty signing in 1851. They've been tricked basically by people into trying to sign this treaty, thinking they're going to get all these benefits. There's a whole bunch of people who know this is going to happen, who basically have run up fake debt on the Native Americans. They set up one table where they're signing the treaty. This was illegal to do, by the way. They set up another table where basically the money was handed out to the people who were their debtor, the creditors, who basically said they were in debt for this much money. And there was basically no way to verify how much it was. And funny story, the people who were the creditors basically said they owed as much as the federal government had promised to pay them. So right off the bat, they were cheated out of all the money that they were basically supposed to get for this treaty by people who basically made up the fake debts, but because no one was really going to stop them from doing it, they did it. And as a matter of fact, there's a lot of people in Washington, D.C. who said, oh, this shouldn't have happened. They tried to hold someone accountable, but they eventually said, ah, you're fine. It was horrible. Then they take that treaty. Now, once again, this is a signed treaty. This is supposed to supersede the Constitution. The Congress alters the treaty, takes away the land that they are supposed to get on the Minnesota River, basically says they're living on our land, so doesn't even recognize the fact that a major contingency of this treaty was they were going to have that land permanently. The Congress basically said, no, they don't. We own that land, and said that they could only live there for 5 years. Now, once again, this is after they signed the treaty. They went through and changed the treaty. What you end up having is the beginning of the cataclysm, which was the Native Americans finally saying, enough. Many of them didn't want to trust the federal government at the Travis DeSue signing. They didn't want to, and they were tricked into doing it by people they trusted who were only in it for the massive amount of land windfall money they were going to receive for basically buying up a bunch of land and then selling it to new European immigrants moving out there, trying to control the growth in the community. From all this, and then the federal government basically took the land away from them, basically was trying to tell them they were going to have to move, was not giving them the supplies that they said they were needed, were not going to give them the grain. Whenever they did give them something, it was broken or a diseased cow. They were starving them to death, and boom, finally, 1862, the Native Americans said, enough's enough. Not because the Native Americans were unreasonable. My God, they were frankly, far more patient than I'd be in that situation. But because they were being killed by these people who basically vilified them constantly with narratives that just did not exist so that they could do what they were doing. Destroying them, destroying their culture, stealing their land, and never even paying them back for what they owned. I said that this Nicollet County Museum is the most Jekyll and Hyde museum I've ever seen in my life. You start in this museum and you go through this history and you feel dark. And you realize, holy God, what an absolute disgusting thing that's happened here. The rest of the museum talks about the various areas of the county and the great farmers that have been there. And I'm like, the dichotomy of those two things was really hard. Oh, you mean the white farmers that basically took the Native American land? Okay, yeah, all right. Sure. They're longtime farmers. Let's congratulate Chet and Mabel. All right, yay, good job, Chet and Mabel. We'll just skip past that whole we screwed over the Native Americans to get the land, but Chet and Mabel, everybody. Wow. I'm not saying that you shouldn't go to it. You should, because if you feel like I am, you're going to be wildly uncomfortable at the end of it, because you're going to be saying to yourself, holy God, we have got to do something here to make amends for this. We have got to do something. And granted, I am a white guy. I've come up with the idea of a national sales tax on every purchase in this country to build up a pool of money that goes to the Native Americans and reparations to the slaves. No one would miss the money. It'd be like 1/100th of a cent and it'd make some money. But at the same time, it's not my place to tell them what they should take. They should have a lot of say in that. Hour two, that's coming up next. Hour number two of the show here on your Tuesday, Matt and Patrick. Brett is in studio with us right now, as he usually joins us here on Tuesdays. Hi, Brett. How are you?
Hello again.
Have you ever had that happen to you? You have a vacation planned. You are on the verge, the cusp of the vacation starting, and it just goes away.
I can't say that's happened to me. No. Mine have pretty much gone as planned, at least in terms of being able to go where I'm supposed to go.
About 15 years ago, 16 years ago, I was supposed to go to Atlanta. I got there. The plane was full. Yeah, this is back when I had young kids. I couldn't afford anything, so I'm back. I'm basically being jammed up into the luggage rack above the above everyone else. And they said, "Oh, it's full." And so, what we can do is we can fly you to Miami. I'll go to Miami. You know, it's like I just went from Atlanta to Miami.
So you just change your trip from Atlanta to Miami with your family?
Well, no, it was by myself.
Oh, you're
and by myself. And what it was a work thing that I had to do, but I had to eventually get down to Miami.
Oh, okay.
Most of my work was in Atlanta. So I gotta tell you the truth, I ended up having to drive a car. That's when I realized how freaking large Florida is, because it takes a long time to drive from Miami up to Atlanta.
Oh, and you're going like northern Georgia too, if you're talking Atlanta.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
Not a short drive.
That was a long drive. But I was doing marketing for a company called Blakeway Panoramas, and they had Miami prints. I hit Orlando, hit Tampa, and just kind of worked Savannah, worked my way up that way. But it ended up, most of my time was supposed to be in Atlanta. And it ended up most of my time was on the road. And I didn't mind because it's Southern food. So
I was going to be impressed if you rescheduled your entire family saying, hey, we're actually going to Miami instead of Atlanta for vacation.
I don't know if I'd take my kids to Miami. I don't know. I don't know. I mean,
not today for sure. Yeah, I wouldn't go to Florida.
Oh, God, there's no way.
But yeah, 15 years ago. Yeah.
You know about those numbers? Yes. You ain't welcome here. Thanks, Florida.
Numbers are woke.
They are. No, I've had that happen before. And I mean, that was, I took 1 or 2 days there in that, but because of the way it worked out, those 1 or 2 days got chewed up just driving on the road, you know, for the most part. I mean, I wasn't planning on visiting most of those towns. I just decided to do it on the, you know, might as well, since I'm down here. You have to kind of be malleable though. I remember we during the pandemic, we were just so much more, you know, accommodating. Mm-hmm. When it came to things. And it's like, initially like, oh no, we can get a camper. They can go sleep in a camper with their COVID. No, I can't do that anymore. So 952-946-6205. Everything go fine here?
Yeah.
You say that with such confidence.
Oh,
sure. Yeah. Why? We didn't eat anyone. Why do you eat us?
No, things went great with Todd. Yeah, especially talking about Trump indictments. We were joking how it could have been the third time you missed a day Trump got indicted. Fortunately, you were here last week when he picked a number three.
I'm very good at missing those things. You know, it's like, well. And thank you very much to Todd for filling in for that. But no, I will say this. Have you gone to the Charles Schulz thing over at the Minnesota History Museum?
I have not yet, no.
Go see that. Go see the treetop walk over at the zoo. That's really nice. It's a little less than 2 miles or so. It's a little less. It's up on the old monorail trail. And it's not like you see animals really good. It is just a spectacular walk, though, because you're up high. And so there's always a constant breeze. That's really nice.
Oh, yeah. You're talking summer? Yeah. It's old monorail line. Yeah, you are going to be above everything and kind of get that bird's eye view. Not quite bird's eye, but a good view of everything.
We were wondering if they're going to have it open in the winter. I would hope they do. I don't see a reason why they couldn't. It might be a cold walk. You'll have to bundle up, but you can still go out and do that. So.
Yeah, really only January would be the month. You probably wouldn't want to do that. December, be good holiday time.
If you did not live here, where would you want to live? If you were to leave, where would you go?
I would probably go somewhere out West Coast.
West Coast?
Yeah. Maybe Seattle, Portland. Mm-hmm. L.A. native myself as a kid, so maybe there too. But yeah, I'd probably think maybe Pacific Northwest to go specific.
Twin Cities residents are Rocky Mountain High on Colorado. Driving. This is from Axios. We asked Axios Twin Cities readers if they were to move in the U.S. and they couldn't live in Minnesota anymore, where would they go? Colorado came in first with 13% at 560 responses. West Coast states, California, Oregon, Washington. There you go. Round out the top four. Maine was number five.
Maine is actually my answer to this question.
It is. What are you looking to become a serial killer?
Maybe I'll be the subject of a Stephen King novel. That's my life dream.
Castle Rock has always got open spaces. Why Maine? No, it's not that. Hey, my brother lives out there. He says it's great. He loves it out there. Why for you?
You know, to be honest, I think because it has a lot of qualities similar to Minnesota with the lakes and the forests and the ocean, of course, if you go up far enough, Lake Superior, it's like an ocean. You wouldn't know the difference if you.
Well, it's. I will say this: you are bordered on New Brunswick. Which, have you been to New Brunswick?
It's on my list. I have not gotten up that far.
That should be low on the list. Nothing against our fine listeners in New Brunswick, but. They do also have the best blueberry pie I've ever had in my life. The blueberries out there grow like grapes. They're amazing. Have you ever cut a piece of pie with like a bunch of, this is blueberries, this is grape pie? No, it's blueberries. Oh my God. It's happy times. Maine number five. Survey is not scientific, but it gives a glimpse at which factors the slice of Minnesotans would transfer if they had to choose a new home state. What the people have said is that people who picked Western states often cited outdoor recreation, natural beauty, liberal politics. Would you notice this? All these conservatives, because, I mean, they opened this up. Axios opened this up to everyone. All these conservatives, I'm leaving. But the top four are not the Maine is kind of more independent. But still, these are all leaning towards the left states. Colorado features my favorite Minnesota recreational activities because I love mountain climbing in Minnesota. But on steroids, one reader wrote. It's also increasingly a diverse state where politics are trending similar to ours. Not going to disagree with that. Northeast also had a strong showing. Maine, Vermont, and Massachusetts ranked all in the top 11. People who chose Maine suggested it reminds them of the North Shore. There you go. Which Vermont lovers wanted to keep living in the state with cold winters and beautiful scenery. A reality check. Wisconsin and Florida and Texas were also top three states for out-migration from Minnesota in 2020 and 2021, according to the IRS. California ranked fifth, Colorado eighth. So that was, you know, Colorado's increased here. Wisconsin gains from Minnesota can be at least partially explained by college reciprocity, people moving to Hudson, nearby cities that become Twin Cities suburbs. But many picked Wisconsin as well as Illinois, number nine, because they have family in those states. The people who picked Florida, Texas, and other southern red states often cited lower non-existent state income taxes, warm weather, and conservative politics. But those were actually fairly low on the list comparatively.
Yeah, I would have thought Florida might have been higher just because of the number of people who are a little bit older that might want to move there. So,
well, I mean, but there, most, I mean, okay, I'll say this. Most of the people who are older that live there come East Coast. They're coming up from the New England area. They come on down there. I'm not saying it's absolute by any means, but it is, there's a lot of that that is going on down there. Let's see here. Where is that full list here? Let me see if I can follow the full list. Oh, not there. Anyway, I can't find it here. But they had a full list here of things where they could go here. But it really was. I think the conservative states all fell a lot lower than you would think they would have. You thought they would have been a little higher there, but no.
Well, your top five were generally all blue states. I mean, Maine is still pretty blue, and obviously you have the West Coast states. So
there seems to be a connection between Minnesota and Colorado lately. I noticed that those two states maybe they're mid-central of the country, and they seem to be the ones that stay saying the bluest there. Lauren Boebert's and Tom Emmer's aside. Minnesota has roughly broken even in over the past 30 years when it comes to gaining or losing residents from other states. For the last couple of years, the scales have tipped more towards losing population and domestic. Actually, Minnesota picked up population. Once again, the U.S. Census Bureau, we actually picked up population. That's just reality. So there you go. If I had to leave, you know, it's all going to be based on food for me. I mean, it really is. It's going to be based on food. I'd probably go back to Rhode Island. I go back to Rhode Island because I got family out there, and I love Dell's Lemonade and you know Judith Point Mussels and lobster and you know, I could easily go to Rhode Island. I could do that. Although, well, maybe South Carolina, because I've become addicted to the Beaufort area in South Carolina. Yeah, probably. Although, yeah, I mean, the rest of that state is, you know, that's a fight on an Alabama dock waiting to happen down there.
And do you want Lindsey Graham as your senator?
No, I don't necessarily want that. You saw that video of the fight on the dock?
I have not, no.
Oh,
no,
okay. You got to see this.
Wait, he got in a fight?
No, not Lindsey Graham, for God's sakes.
I'd be watching that.
It was amazing.
He probably would have lost, too.
I will show you. I'll tell you what. I'll show you the video of the dock fight here in just a second here. Patrick Cooligan joining you here in just a moment, correct?
Yeah, we are going to be speaking with Patrick Cooligan as he has some thoughts on Dean Phillips raising speculation that he may be running for president in 2024 or at least wants someone else to challenge Biden. Plus, we are going to be getting a little bit into some of these reforms that have been proposed by Police Chief O'Hara over at the Minneapolis Police Department. So where we're going today, talking Dean Phillips and the MPD.
I think O'Hara's trying to fix things. I'm willing to give him the slack. I'm think O'Hara's trying to fix it.
We'll get into it a little bit too, but yeah, it's tough with that rank and file too in the union.
Yeah,
which,
it does. I think
a lot of pushback.
His heart's in the right place. Whether he's be able to accomplish it, we'll have to see. It's Patrick Cooligan from the Minnesota Reformer with Brett right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's Brett Johnson with you here on a Tuesday afternoon as we are joined by the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, Patrick Cooligan, who is going to be chatting about some of the stories that they have been working on over at the Minnesota Reformer, including some reforms that are going to be implemented at the Minneapolis Police Department. Plus, we are going to get Patrick's thoughts on Representative Dean Phillips possibly entering the Democratic presidential primary race. So, Patrick, thanks so much for coming back on the show today.
Always a pleasure.
So let's start off with your column talking about Dean Phillips, who, of course, is from the 3rd Congressional District, which includes pretty much all of the West Metro area here in the Twin Cities. And he made some waves by proposing a potential presidential run. He didn't announce that he is running, but he seemed somewhat open to the idea of possibly running for president in 2024 and challenging Joe Biden in the Democratic primary. So why is Phillips proposing such a move, and why does he think that could help the Democratic Party? Well, those are questions that we are going to chat about right now with Patrick. So I'm curious, Patrick, before we dive into some of the politics of this and the strategy, what are some of the people that are close to Dean Phillips saying about why he's potentially considering this run? Because as I understand it, you had a chance to speak to a few people who are kind of close to Dean Phillips. So I'm curious what their thoughts are on this calculation of him potentially entering the Democratic primary.
Yeah, it's really not about him. And in a way, it was, this may sound strange, but we live in strange times. I think he was trying to create a conversation around the need for an alternative for Democrats, or at least the need for a primary. And that sort of entailed floating the idea that if nobody else is going to do it, I'm going to do it. But in general, what he's more interested in is a conversation amongst Democrats about where we are, Democrats broadly, 15 months before the election. And it seems kind of perilous if you really kind of get into the details. And by that, I'm referring to recent polling showing that the president's job approval rating is only 39%. That's a New York Times Siena poll. That's pretty much the gold standard polling. He runs even with former President Trump, who's the likely nominee, and more so every day. And the problem with running even with Trump in a national poll is that Republicans generally have a electoral college advantage. So you run even with Trump, you're likely to lose. And I think that the consequences of a Trump second term are pretty devastating for American democracy. So I think that's the conversation, is that President Biden is doing poorly in the polls. He's especially doing especially poorly with young voters. And he's going to be 82 years old when he's president. I mean, I think that's the issue that people we're not talking about because it's a little awkward. But that's the reality of the situation. And I think anybody who's had aging parents, relatives, or friends know that things happen after the age of 80, especially. So I think that's the conversation that he's trying to provoke. And we can talk more about that.
Well, you also cited that there are some big concerns with younger voters and people who potentially could be voting for Joe Biden, as this New York Times poll showed that just 1% of 18 to 29-year-olds strongly approve of the way he's been handling his job as president, and 94% of Democrats under the age of 30 said they wanted another candidate to run in 2024. So I'm curious how big of a worrying sign this should be for Democrats, because oftentimes I hear them say, well, if we look at younger voters, the majority of them, if not almost all of them, when presented with a choice on Election Day in 2024, any other year, will generally come home and vote for Joe Biden or the Democratic candidate simply because, well, the Republican is so awful that they couldn't stomach being able to put a Republican. How big of a concern should this be? Because I also do look at that under 30 class, which is very highly educated on candidates. And do you buy the idea that maybe they come home in 2024? Or should this be a big concern for Dems as we head into the 2024 cycle?
Well, the one advantage that Democrats have with every passing year is that a significant number of these new voters become eligible, these younger voters, and they lean heavily Democratic. And then at the same time, the older voters who lean Republican are dying, and it leads to a net positive for Democrats every year. And so they ought to be doing increasingly well. But these voters will stay home. I mean, young voters generally are tough to motivate to get out. And so that's the real concern, that you have this important voter bloc for Democrats increasingly, and should lead to advantages for Democrats over time. But if you're at 1% with them, even if they prefer you to the alternative, are they going to be motivated to turn out, let alone volunteer and do all the things that help you win elections?
And you also brought up in your column that if something were to happen to Joe Biden before Election Day 2024, certainly we don't hope that happens, but let's be honest, he is in his early 80s right now. The question would be, who would enter the picture as the Democratic nominee if something were to happen to Biden next year? And it sounds like you have some concerns about some of the alternatives that could potentially pop up, like Kamala Harris. So potentially, maybe this would be helpful to have a Democratic primary, so you at least would have someone who's kind of rearing and ready to go should that need arise come up in 2024, correct?
Yeah, if something were to happen to Biden, and there's a non-trivial chance that that could happen, somebody who's 80 years old, the natural response would be to elevate the vice president. The problem is, I don't really have anything against Kamala Harris, Vice President Harris. She certainly brings some assets to the table, but she's had kind of an impossible job. They've given her a very difficult portfolio. And you might even wonder if they've done that on purpose. And partly as a result of that, her numbers are even worse than Biden's. So the idea of a competitive primary, or at least nominally competitive primary, is that it would give folks a chance to stand up a campaign in terms of the infrastructure of it, raise money. You know, you go out on the campaign trail, and I mean, I've seen it myself. These folks, they get better as they do more of it. And so you need that. It would force President Biden to get on the debate stage, prep for debate, and to do outreach to young voters. And so that if something, so there's a lot of benefits to it. And if something does happen to President Biden, God forbid, there's somebody there, and let's say that Kamala then steps up. Okay, well, you know, but then you'd want another alternative, at least one. And I think Democratic voters are saying, or telling pollsters and reporters that that they want more choices. So to me, there's a lot of upside to this and a huge risk if you're putting all your eggs into the basket of a guy who's clearly capable and vigorous, but still 80 years old.
So you're telling me RFK Jr. is probably not the good alternative we should be looking for Joe Biden, correct?
Yeah, I mean, Dean Phillips, he was on Face the Nation this weekend, and he was asked about RFK Jr., and Phillips had the right response. RFK Jr. is not a Democrat. He doesn't have, his positions are not aligned with the Democratic Party in any way. The only reason he called him a Democrat is because of his family. And the fact that he's even in the race and pulling at these numbers, it's entirely due to his family as well as his fans with a bunch of anti-vaxxers that we really don't want in public life. So that's not the alternative here. And you know, the way I kind of envision this primary going is that it's certainly not going to be negative, because nobody's going to take shots at Joe Biden. I mean, he is beloved by most Democrats. He's accomplished a lot. A lot of the goals of progressives and Democrats more broadly. He's a party man through and through. So every time the party has shifted, he's shifted with them. So it's not going to be some long, drawn-out ideological fight. That's not what I'm envisioning here. It's a much friendlier primary that is probably over pretty quickly, but it does give Biden a chance to campaign and to explain to Democrats why he should be the standard bearer again. It forces them to prepare for the coming debates, and get out and engage with younger voters.
So what do you say to the notion that primaries are usually bad for political parties and specifically presidents? Because at least when I look at open primaries, they seem to actually be helpful for political parties. Back in 2008 with Hillary versus Obama, even the Democrats in 2020 had a relatively competitive primary. You could even make the argument that the Republicans had a competitive primary back in 2016. But it is a little bit different when you're primarying an actual sitting president, where the history is a little bit more mixed, if not completely negative, when it comes to someone who is challenging an incumbent president. What do you say to that argument that, well, if we primary the president, it usually ends up hurting their political party, and then the sitting president usually ends up losing in the general election anyways?
Yeah, I mean, you go to 1968, Eugene McCarthy basically knocks LBJ out of the White House. 1980, where Ted Kennedy took on Jim Jimmy Carter and almost certainly hurt Carter. George H.W. Bush was hurt in 1992 by Patrick Buchanan. So, yeah, there is a record there. However, I would point out, I mean, first of all, it's only a handful. So it's not like there's some statistically meaningful sample that we can rely on. But then also, all of those involve really fierce, divisive, ideological fights in the party. Certainly, Eugene McCarthy was the anti-war candidate. You had 1980, Ted Kennedy was definitely running from the left against Carter, and Patrick Buchanan was running from the right against George H.W. Bush. And that division in the party stayed through Election Day. I don't really see that here. And I don't think it would be that kind of primary. I think it would give somebody a chance, introduce themselves to Democratic voters, make their pitch. The reality is that Democratic voters are almost certainly going to stick with Joe Biden, but maybe not. And so the voters will have their say. But if Biden is primaried, and as I would suspect would come out of this, I think stronger. Because he wouldn't have that divisive ideological battle going on. It would be a different kind of primary.
Well, you can read more about that column over at MinnesotaReformer.com. MinnesotaReformer.com, as you can read Patrick's latest column about Dean Phillips musing the idea of potentially entering the presidential race. One more story I wanted to talk about that you guys are working on over at The Reformer has to do with what Dina Winter has been reporting on, and that's Minneapolis Police Chief Brian O'Hara announcing a restructuring of the department, putting a new leadership team largely in place, as he named two assistant chiefs and five deputy chiefs, and basically reorganized the department into two divisions, an operations division and a community trust division. So I'm curious, let's talk a little bit about what each of these will do. I mean, operations to me seems fairly straightforward and obvious, but I'm a little bit more curious about what this community trust division does, because within that, it looks like they'll also have a constitutional policing bureau, a new internal affairs bureau, and a restructured professional standards bureau. So let's talk a little bit about some of these reforms that they are going to be implemented at the Minneapolis Police Department, and specifically this community trust division.
Yeah, so O'Hara says that comes from best practices. So looking at police departments around the country that have better relationships with the communities that they serve, and that this structure he's taken from mimics from other departments that are doing better. And you have to like that he's at least trying something on this front. I love the phrase constitutional policing. The question is, will the rank and file accept these changes and start to make the changes that are going to be necessary, not just to be a better police department, but also to abide by the agreement with the State Department of Human Rights, and was expected to be in agreement with the Department of Justice after they made their findings that the department has a history in the recent past of discriminatory policing.
So how has O'Hara largely been kind of getting along with the rank and file officers? I know Adina at least had a chance to speak to him a little about that, so I'm curious what he said.
Yeah, he said he's got some folks. Most he thinks most folks are ready to move the department forward, but not everybody's a fan. And I mean, I think you've seen recently where the union hit at him pretty hard when they fired an officer, and I think there's some grumbling amongst some in the rank and file, but I don't think that's really been fleshed out yet. So we'll just have to see how this new structure takes shape and whether or not it has an effect on the culture of the department.
You can read more about Dina's great reporting on this and some of the reforms that are going to be implemented by Police Chief Brian O'Hara over at MinnesotaReformer.com, as we have been speaking with Patrick Houlihan, who is the editor-in-chief of the Minnesota Reformer, talking through reforms at the Minneapolis Police Department, as well as Dean Phillips potentially entering the Democratic presidential primary race. Patrick, as always, thanks for coming on the show today. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure.
All right, let's take a break and send things back over to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
Hi, I'm Scott Chambaud from Chambaud Family Dentistry. We're the fear-free, shame-free dental office. We know dental anxiety and dental phobia are real. We'll take the time to get to know you and give you what you need to be comfortable at all times. We offer free nitrous oxide laughing gas and have high-tech options to help you feel calm and relaxed during your appointment.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. As you can imagine, with the fact that I have had a, once again, COVID strike a little closer to home, it's why not have Dr. Joe Eastman come join us again, our COVID modeling expert. He has, of course, worked for NASA. He's worked for the LTER, worked for Colorado State University, currently on the University of Texas Austin COVID modeling team, living in Grand Rapids, kind enough to join us today to talk about all things COVID. Hey, Dr. Joe, how are you?
I'm doing great, but I'll get better. I really need to know how you are doing. I missed the very first 10 minutes of the show today, so
well,
I didn't hear what was going on.
Well, it's not me. We were supposed to go up for the four-day weekend. We were supposed to head up north to the cabin, and we got a call Thursday night as we're packing things up saying, oh, by the way, one of the people that's came out from the East Coast, had COVID. They tested positive for COVID, and so ended up kind of, you know, derailing the weekend. Whoa. Obviously, first of all, all the concern is for her. She's basically doing better, which is good. They've got the Plavaxlin, the prescription stuff that they got, and you know, she's just been resting, but you know, it looks like she's doing better, which is good news. Obviously, this is, you know, it's kind of one of those things. They're not quite sure where they got it from. I mean, if I could ask you, you know this better than I do. What's the incubation time for being exposed to COVID to being testing positive for COVID?
It varies a little bit, but roughly 3 days is about the benchmark for that. So, there's probably other people infected by her. Wow.
Well, and she... Well, and she basically she got that, and she's feeling better. So 3 days would mean she got it before the flight. So, you know, am I crazy here? I'm seeing all of a sudden I'm seeing COVID cases start to pop up all over the place again.
It's you know, my newest wastewater estimates and other scientists are well over 400,000 new cases per day. To put that in perspective, the first massive wave, you know, from the original wild-type variant back in 2020-21 was about 300,000 a day. The only difference was people were dying at nearly a 10% rate, and it's down to 1% now. It doesn't appear as frightening, but then when you factor in the number of people getting long COVID and the excess deaths caused by that, we're at a scary juncture right now. I'll just put it bluntly.
It is not over. There's a lot of people that are saying it's over. 1 million new COVID cases happened worldwide, globally. In the 28 days leading up to August 3rd, that's 1 million new cases. The total amount of deaths, and once again, deaths are down, 3,100 total deaths worldwide. But at the same time, it doesn't factor in the long COVID and the conditions there that obviously are still a big part of this problem. Okay, so let's talk about these variants. What are the variants that we're seeing that are all of a sudden starting to become a little bit more, I don't want to say resilient, but they're starting to become more common. We're starting to see more of them.
Yeah. The big one right now is, of course, the EG.5 and also FL.1.5. And you have a particular mutation that is somewhat concerning on the spike protein. And what it does is it bonds even tighter to the infection site, the ACE receptor on your cells. And dislodging it is really tough right now. You know, personally, I know some people that have gotten their butts kicked by this newest strain, and they can't seem to get over it for a long time. And then you look at Hawaii. I don't know if you've ever been there, but the amount of influx of Japanese tourists in Hawaii is pretty astonishing. And all of a sudden, they're seeing numbers that they haven't seen in over 2 years. So it's, you know, worldwide, this new mutation is roughly 35% of new mutations have this. And then when it's combined with what we call the flip gene mutation, one is at the F, between the F and L sites of the gene, and the other is between the L and the F. So thus we call it the flip gene mutation combination. And that one is also the L455F mutation is creating even better immune evasion to your T cells and B cells and all the cells that do the work to fight it off. So this thing, you know, all the mutations used to be on the body, and now we're starting to see some more spike mutations, and that it's getting really frightening to me just because of the longevity, and that's why you're getting this long COVID, and the asymptomatic rates because of the immune evasion are just going through the roof right now. So we don't even know how many people are walking around us that have it, and they don't know it. Mm-hmm. So we're in a horrible situation right now.
Well, it's the EG5 and FL.1.5. Any idea where those originated from?
This is something I should know.
That's all right.
I had chemo today. My chemo brain is not working on that one right now. Uh-huh. But, I cannot remember for the life of me, but I'll make sure I put that out to you, and you can let the people know. I believe one of them was in Southeast Asia, was the place of origin. So, you know, and again, you look at China and 65 million cases a day. Just wow. Put that in perspective. They're starting to feel it in their workforce now. So once it starts affecting the economy, all of a sudden people start paying a little more attention to it, unfortunately. Should be doing this for the last 3 years.
Well, but, the fatality rate, though, is the fatality rate less on these, or is it in that same? Because, like I said, for a while there, it was really bad, and those first strains were really high. But it's calmed down to a point. I mean, it still is pretty dangerous if you think about it in the scheme of illnesses. Even 1 out of 100 is a pretty atrocious return on that. But you know, right. are they seeing a spike in deaths with this?
Not yet. But, you know, it's mainly because we've learned how to treat it better, for one thing. I mean, some of the things we're doing initially were just plain wrong. And that was leading to some of the fatalities, unfortunately. But we've learned a lot. And like we say, we got it down to 1%, which still ain't great. I mean, when you start getting 400,000 plus cases a day just here in the United States, that translates to a lot of death, and it's unacceptable as far as I'm concerned. And you know what we've done is we're not using our intelligence. You know, the virus has no intelligence, but boy, it's really good at natural selection, because we're letting it keep breeding, and the more times it breeds, the more mutations, and some of those mutations are going to catch on and spread to other variants and recombinants and such. So we can't continue like we are right now. And hopefully people will read. I think I put a pretty good newsletter today on on just where we should go and masking and boosters and all of that. So, it's not a good situation.
And I'll put a link out to that newsletter a little bit later on. You also have another variant here, which you're concerned about, XBB.2.3. What's that one?
Yeah, and that was one that kind of flew under my radar. You know, everybody is concentrating on the EG5.1 and ignored the FL1.5 and this XBB.2.3, which also has similar mutations, that one spike mutation mutation that I was talking about with the F to L mutation. And, if you look at it countrywide, each area or region of the country has got a different dominant variant right now. And this goes back to something I've been saying for over 3 years. Local mitigation strategies and compliance truly matter, including weather and things like that. We need to get a handle on this. And each area now has kind of their own climate, virus climate that's going on. And XBB 2.3 is leading in one of the regions of the United States right now. The other one's FL1.5 in another region, and then the one we keep hearing about now, the EG5.1. So it is a very complicated situation that is pretty much of our own doing. I'll put it that way.
Dr. Joe Eastman and joining us right now. Now, the last time we talked with you, you said it probably would be a good idea to wait until the fall booster, you know, not mess with the current one, go wait to the fall booster and just get it then. Have you changed your mind on that? Are you like, okay, no, at this point, just go get a booster?
The CDC kind of messed this one up for us again. All of a sudden, they're saying October. We want to wait another month. If you're on the edge and you're past your 6 month, maybe I don't know if I would, you know, just endorse getting the old booster. But if you look at a genetic map of this booster and compare it with like the EG5.1 or FL1.5, it is the best match by far of any vaccine booster we have had since this whole thing started. So if you can hold out, get that and the RSV vaccine at the same time, and then maybe wait a couple weeks and then get your flu shot. That's kind of the protocol I've been recommending to others, and that's exactly what I'm going to do. So that would be my best advice right now.
All right. And that vaccine is available once again. When are they expecting that one to be available?
The beginning of October. All right. It's supposed to be the beginning of September. So we're another month off. And the thing is, the CDC needs to be promoting this just gung-ho. I kind of hear crickets. Nobody knows when this thing's coming out. Well, that's partially their fault, and that's part of their job, is give us just common language information about what the heck is going on and what to expect down the road. But we'll see if they change. The new director is just getting installed there and up to speed, so we'll see what happens. The other thing is the hospitals are starting to go back to some masking, but not enough. I mean, that's the most obvious place for it. And then we got the kids coming back to school time. And, it's really sporadic how much we've retrofitted our HVAC systems in the schools. And, of course, we have no mask mandate in the schools either. So we're going to see the kids spreading that and the flu. I think this is going to be a long winter. I'm sorry to say.
You talked about the CDC and the failures there, but the reality is it sounds like a lot of places are. One of the notes you sent me here, of the wastewater regions, only 3 of 9 have reported. That means 6. That means 2/3 of the wastewater regions haven't reported. Now, have they not reported because they just were running late, or are they just not reporting anymore?
It's a combination of both. What's happened was, the debt ceiling bill pretty much targeted cuts in funding that could be used by these communities for COVID and wastewater and such. Some of the plants are just quit reporting now, and they said, heck with it. If this is not needed and it's costing us money, then we got to shut it down. And then what happens is the whole CDC and the BioBot people, they got to go through new normalization processes and things like that to get the data, you know, QA'd and QC'd so that it's the best data set that they can deliver. And obviously there's places that are falling behind right now. If you look at this worldwide, I got wastewater numbers from all over the globe. I'm working with the World Health Network on that kind of project right now. And what you see is this EG 5.1 just exploding in countries all over the place. I'll send you that graph. It is so dramatic, and it's a big pause for concern.
It's not going away. We, you know, it's you need to get vaccinated. I mean, for your suggestion right now, if you had your say, pretty much if you're going anywhere right now, masking is probably, it's not the worst idea to bring it back again.
Right, exactly. It's definitely needed. And I put a little thing in there today about from a philosopher and how she, the Asian countries look at this, and they're like, why do you, people ask them, why do you mask? For our health, obviously. Mm. Well, okay, but we politicized it, and I don't know if we'll ever get back to the peak of about 70% compliance for masking, and we need to do that, not just when these upticks come, but for an extended period so we can buy some time to really come up with our best solutions possible and give us scientists more time to evaluate what's going on. We are really getting a handle on the genetic mutations and what kind of symptoms they're going to cause and how they're going to give the virus a growth advantage. So that is all good news. But then the bad news is the funding's drying up because everybody thinks it's over. So.
Well, and it's like it is. It's political. Trump basically turned, you know, used it as to help his political aspirations. And there are so many people here that are so willing to go with it. It's sad. All right. You've given us some advice. We know what we need to do. Whether people will do it, that's not much can say. But I can tell you right now, I'm seeing it, and it's impacting people already. So, and as you said, when the kids got back in school, what happened every year? It got really bad. If this EG5 is out there, it's in, and the kids have got it, it's going to do what the other ones did. And I think it's going to be hard to convince people to go back, but hopefully, you know, it's not, you know, hopefully it's not as deadly as some of the other strains.
Very well said. And yeah, we do have our medical treatments on our side, but they're quickly running out of effectiveness. So, we need more research.
Dr. Joe, I appreciate the time as always. I'm going to put out the newsletter. Follow his newsletter. He's got a lot of great information there. And frankly, just be careful. We don't want you sick, we don't want you dead, and we don't want you bankrupt for the rest of your life. So basically, that's the deal. That's the whole point. Dr. Joe, as always, I was hoping to see you this weekend. Unfortunately, I'm going to miss you. Maybe I'll try another time. All my best. Take care, and thank you very much as always, my friend.
Thank you, kind sir, as always.
Take care.
You stay safe.
You bet. Bye-bye. Dr. Joe Eastman, kind enough to join us today, 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. The Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, the Matt McNeil Show. Yeah, it's, and no one's going to care. You're doom and glooming it, Matt. We're fine. I will say this, the friend that got sick up at the cabin, it sounded like for 2 days they weren't able to move, and they're still slowly coming out of it. So I don't want that to happen to anyone. That's the whole point. All right, real quick here. Dean Phillips, of course, is still kind of floating around the idea that we need to you know, possibly, you know, primary Biden because he's old. Now, here's two things I'm going to say. Three things. One, I don't mind if someone primaries him. That's the rules. If someone wants to primary him, they can primary him. I don't think he needs to be primaried. I personally think Joe Biden's had an amazing first term, and I support him if he wants to run again. That being said, if someone wants to challenge him, those are the rules. He can do that. Number two, if the Democrats are going to try to pick someone else, can we make sure that we pick someone who doesn't just agree with the Democrats 70% of the time? And I'm tired of people who I'm really a Democrat. And then the minute that the primary is over, it's like, I'm working with the other side every chance I get. Well, that's not a Democrat. And then thirdly, this is that this just screams that Dean Phillips seems to be listening to and believing the right-wing narrative on these stories. And we've talked about that before. You can't trust that. Native Roots Radio, I'm Awake. That's coming up next. We're back tomorrow. Until then, see you.